Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I, honest to God, don't know what the theme is today.
Well, it's farming.
Farming.
It starts off with farming.
Okay.
And then finishes up with a super-duper cookbook.
Which has nothing to do with farming.
It's nothing to do with farming. Okay. No. I didn't have any more farms.
Well, let's start with the farm. It was a real pleasure talking to Chris Fisher about Beetlebung Farm.
Yeah, I had trouble with Beetlebung. I wanted to introduce a number of other words. I don't know if you can guess what they possibly could be. But Chris's family's been in the farming business on Martha's Vineyard for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. In the meantime, he started out chefing around the world, but then decided to come home. And he's enjoying both farming and chefing where he grew up.
I have to admit that I'm very envious of Chris Fisher. He is the author of the Beetlebung Farm Cookbook, which is what we're going to be talking about today. But I am jealous of your life, Chris, growing up on Martha's Vineyard the way you did with absolutely marvelous characters all around you and a fascinating family full of interesting people with good longevity genes, right?
Yeah.
Tell us, you are both a chef and a researcher in some ways in the history of Martha's Vineyard, cooked in the United States coast to coast and in Europe in some really interesting places, and you write really lyrically and well. A lot of your recipes are sort of rustic, which I guess reflects this, the farm to table. Your writing is really polished.
Well, thank you. I had the idea I wanted to start writing about food, so I first read as much as I could for as long as I could, and then suggested to the Martha's Vineyard Gazette that they didn't have a food column, so the food column started every 2 weeks, and then it sort of turned into a column on island life, and I just found having a deadline was like having homework, and so without that, it's hard to motivate yourself to produce the work. So
this is true.
Now, hold on a second. Anne mentioned that you're a writer and that you're a chef. What she didn't mention, but which is probably patently obvious from the name of the book, is you're also...
Yes.
And you're probably a farmer first and foremost.
I don't know what I am first and foremost. I dropped out of college halfway through completing my degree, and working and living on Martha's Vineyard, you do a variety of things, including take care of properties and or your property, wherever you end up living. And my family happened to congregate around Beetlebung Farm, owned by my grandfather, and so it was just natural to want to spend time with him, spend time with the family. We would gather every day and have lunch there as a family, and that became a great tradition. And so there was a lot of osmosis, but that only goes so far with practical skill. So I basically left the island and began cooking before I came back and really concentrated on farming. So whether it's an approach, a curious approach to everything, I feel like I've chosen three professions, I guess, that you never stop learning. And so I constantly feel that I'm still in the process with all of it. So currently I just try to do my best with every project that is in front of me, whether it's a meal to cook or a restaurant or a crop to plant or a book to write. So it's kind of a complicated life, and I appreciate the enviousness of the idyllic life that I portray here, but it's definitely a lot of fun juggling. I can't complain besides...
Oh, I don't doubt that there's a lot of hard work.
You're probably never bored, never stuck with what's going to happen next. The structure of the book is interesting because you take a year in the life of food on Martha's Vineyard, but there are really
two very different seasons, aside from the ones on the regular calendar. There's the 2 months of craziness when the island becomes heavily populated, including the President of the United States and his family, and then the other 10 months of the year when there's hardly anybody there.
This is true. That's when all the prep work is done, I would say, ideally. Yeah, we broke the seasons down into 6 sections because we felt that having just 4 seasons was a little bit too broad, because the reality of the seasons here and New England seasons in general is that from week to week things change, from day to day even, and so there's so much variety in what is grown and eaten and consumed, much broader than a 4-season calendar. So
you've got the land, you've got the sea, you've got different seasons, you've got a lot of mixing up of everything here, right?
Yeah, and a mixture, like you said, too, of a dense population and, you know, lots of people in the summertime with very different tastes and practical, lively, you know, practicalities and budgets than what happens the rest of the year. So it's an incredibly dynamic place in that sense, that you really get to experience how so many people live. And so certainly growing up on Martha's Vineyard, the tourist destination shaped so much of my life. Yeah, and the idea behind the format of the book was to start the book in that less glamorous time for Martha's Vineyard. It's always the same feeling in the fall when everybody leaves and goes back to school and goes back to their lives on the mainland, and islanders kind of relish that that time to relax and enjoy their bounty and swim finally and have shared meals, all the things you're not able to do in the summertime when the majority of people are making their livelihood for the season, uh-huh, for the whole year. So Secret Summer, we called it, was really just that sort of a glimpse into that beautiful time of year that we appreciate, and hopefully I hope that people can come down and enjoy that as well, and I also hope that they don't, so we can continue to have
sure.
that quiet.
Yeah, come, but not too many of you all at once.
Exactly.
Well, you know, you start out, you have your seasons, then you start out with a menu that you're going to cook through,
yep,
and then you have the recipes. You also have stories that go with your life and with life on the farm. And you have really, who's the woman now with the salad that she tossed 1,000 times? What's her name?
Say that again. The woman.
Serena. Was it Serena?
Oh, yes.
She tossed the salad 1,000 times?
Yeah, that was her playful description of just making sure that you get every single leaf coated with the dressing equally.
Uh-huh.
Her touch was very delicate, and she's another person in my life that I serendipitously found both through her relationship to the farm and through my relationship with her grandson, who was a good friend. And I've always been drawn, maybe it's growing up here, to spending time with every different age group, and you really have that access here. And so she had an amazing husband who won the Nobel Prize in Economics in the, I think, early 80s, and or maybe it was the 70s, and they moved here and they loved it here, and she had that Italian approach to food, and so she just loved good ingredients, simple ingredients, and she was coming to the farm long before I was involved, and first getting her hair done at the salon there, and then she would buy her produce and her flowers, and she needed her lawn mowed after her husband passed away, so I volunteered to do it, and then I started mowing her trails around her property to get to her wild blueberry patches so she could make jelly. And we just forged a great friendship, and she would make us lunch, and it was like a cooking lesson every time. It was so simple and beautiful, and yeah, she was a very impactful person in my life.
As I said, you have a lot of fresh, simple ingredients that you use. There's no mistaking, though, that these recipes are designed by a chef. there's that sophisticated edge to them.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think the point, when I wrote the book, Catherine Young and I had a really fun process of getting together and getting the ingredients we'd want for that time of year, and sometimes new ones would show up and we'd have a concept and then we would just cook. And she's written many great books, and
I think we've interviewed her, by the way.
Yeah, and so we would get together and cook, and the idea, she stressed to me the entire time, you know, it's really important that people can take this book and cook with it. And I wanted it to be a cookbook where chefs could take a look and say, wow, that is so simple and inspiring, but I see the technical technique there, and they could learn from it. And somebody who's a home cook who went to the farmer's market, or a busy mother or a busy father, could take these simple recipes with very few ingredients and learn about just being mindful on how not to mess with things too much. And if you start with really great ingredients, you don't need to. And so I appreciate that you noticed that, because I think that's important. That was important to us all along, that it had that chef's perspective, but it was simple enough for people to say, pick up the book and use it and get it dirty.
Well, I said to Peter, you know, here's something we never even thought of, although we have access to fresh beets and green tomatoes and radishes. Putting mm-hmm. them together never occurred to me.
Well, yeah, and in the fall, I think that was from an October menu, that all came together because the Indian summer, or the sort of warm October we had, I think it was 2 years ago when we made that recipe, came about, and North Tabor Farm down the road was ripping out all of their tomatoes that were in their greenhouse and still producing but had green fruit on them, and the beets were perfect and the radishes were perfect that time of year from the field. And so yeah, they all kind of happened at the same time, and we found that the sweetness of the beets and the tart tomatoes and the sharpness from the radishes just were perfect together.
Yeah, well, as I said, that's a creative assemblage right there that somebody who's not gastronomically or culinarily trained probably wouldn't hit on.
Well, thank you again. And yeah, it I spend all of my time thinking about food in every form, including reading lots and lots and lots and eating other people's food as much as I can. So I definitely value having those references when the ingredients come
right
in front of you. You can draw off of this meal you had somewhere, or this one flavor of the way somebody prepared, you know, a beet so perfectly. And so,
well,
yeah, I just...
It's also impressive how early your father started teaching you to hunt and how to handle animals you caught. Like, I mean, I came from a hunting family, too, so I appreciate seeing these deer swinging around hanging up there.
Well, I would say that he started by first making us very comfortable with the idea that you would walk into your barn and if the lights were off, you'd try to find your way to the light switch without bumping into a hanging deer. And so that smell and that process, and when I was young, I would look out the window and see he and his friends drive off and their orange or camouflage and then come back, and it starts with watching the process, and then the second step would probably be learning how to shoot a gun, and then once you're old enough and lucky enough, then you can venture out in the woods. I don't think I tell the story in the book, but I have a younger sister who just graduated from college, and she was always a great shot. She was a better shot than any of us, really, uh-huh, with a gun. And she was interested in what my dad was doing. And so he had shot a deer, and he wounded it, and it ran off in the woods. And it was night, so he came home and got a flashlight, and she was at home. She was in kindergarten. And she said, can I come track the deer with you? So he went out in the woods, and they followed the trail of blood through the woods and finally came upon this deer where he showed her how to gut it and clean it, and that was an experience I hadn't had at that young. They brought it back home, he hung it up, It was a wonderful experience for the two of them. He brought her to school the next morning and dropped her off, and as he was walking away, he looked back at her, and he noticed that her shoes were covered in blood as she walked into kindergarten. So I guess those things happen when you grow up in a rural community.
That's great. Now, I told you I was intrigued totally with your rabbit with fennel recipe, and you mm-hmm. offered to walk me through it.
Yeah, well, rabbits are very prevalent here, and the Portuguese love rabbit, and so a lot of Portuguese actually come over from New Bedford, because that's a big Portuguese community, and in January, I think it's January, is the official rabbit season, although you can shoot one in your backyard anytime, really, with a 22. And in cooking rabbit for meat, I find that it's a really lean meat, so
it's
easy to dry it out. And even if you're doing something like a rabbit loin or something, it needs some moisture. And I've spit roasted rabbits. I did one for a greenhouse dinner I did once, and I was so excited. I had Adam Platt was coming to dinner, the New York Times or New York Magazine food writer, and I was nervous. And we ended up serving this dried out rabbit, which I just to this day wish was so much better. So I've always felt that braising the rabbit, at least a good section of it, really just allows for a lot more wiggle room in cooking time and technique. And when I cooked in Rome, there was a chef there that had a sort of a hybrid of a California influenced recipe and a Roman recipe, where you just brown a rabbit and a big pan and add some white wine and olives and fennel and orange zest, I think, or orange rinds, and just, you know, cover it and braise it and make sure it's nice and moist. And so, and we were getting whole rabbits in, and so I love the butchering process. There's a lot of meat on rabbits, especially the hind legs, and so take the whole thing and take a very similar approach with the fennel and onions, and there's some anchovy in there as well. And then we took the loin, and I found that when you butcher a rabbit, you can leave the belly on, and you can wrap the loin in the belly, and that really holds more moisture in as well. And
mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, that was my inspiration, and it's a nice way you get nice pan juices that can continually moisten the meat. And then the blanched carrots and celery root are just like bright, beautiful versions of themselves, and it just all worked well together.
Sounds fabulous. That's one on my to-try list. Whose birthday is January 3rd?
It's my birthday, actually.
It's our granddaughter's birthday, isn't it? It was at the 4th.
She's the 4th.
Yeah, January 4th.
It's an unfortunate time of year to have a birthday because everybody's so tired of celebrating things after Christmas and New Year's. And so.
Well, mine's in July, and I never even got a school party. Well, anyhow, I hope you're getting a good reception to this book because it's so interesting on so many levels, and I can't wait to try some of the recipes.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we put a lot of effort into it. I worked with Emma Young, who is a artist here on the island, who did all of the original art on her 19th century letterpress.
Oh, machine.
And so everything was made by hand, and I think that really shows, including the cover art and all the menus. And the photography, too, was taken over probably 6 years, and so it all came naturally. Not much was staged, and I said to someone recently, I mean, it took us 4 or 5 years to write, but my family's been here for 350, so it was really just a drop in the bucket I had a lot of material to draw off of.
Well, I wish you success on it. Again, listeners, it's the Beetlebung Farm, and Beetlebung is a kind of a tree that grows, that's native to Martha's Vineyard. And the author, chef, and farmer who was responsible for producing it is Chris Fisher. And it's a wonderful book, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And don't go away, because we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Here's a new thought on my horizon, and hopefully on yours too, from Natasha Bowen. Her book is called The Color of Food, and it's something that had never crossed my mind before.
It's a project. I mean, it's a project that will eventually, I guess, turn out to be a lifetime concept, because this lady's really got something going, and she's got a topic that's really quite fascinating, a fascinating piece of American social history, a story beautifully told by a very interesting person.
Who's a good writer, too.
Yeah, and a good photographer.
And a good photographer, photography.
This is one you should read and look at and enjoy.
And people just pop out of the page.
And absorb what it means, because it's a part of American history that too much of the time we don't think about. And with all the incidents that have been going on in the Old South recently, it's even more important, I think, that you pay attention to the message that's here in The Color of Food.
Natasha Bowens has a blog called Brown Dot Girl Farming, right, Natasha?
Brown Girl Farming, yep.
Right. And you've just written The Color of Food, Stories of Race, Resilience, and Farming. And I received this in the mail, a review copy, and I have to say, it was an issue that had never, ever occurred to me. Isn't that part of the problem?
That's a part of the problem, and that's you are not alone. So, but, the reason I wrote the book.
I started thinking when my great-uncle had a dairy farm in southern Ohio, and all the farmers in that area interacted. I spent half my life at farmers markets. I'm tuned into this whole new food movement. I don't think I've ever met a black farmer.
I think you just did.
Well,
I just did.
Good to meet you.
But, I mean, it's something that, I guess I never even thought of as an issue. But, like everything else, it'll always come down to race, doesn't it? And money.
Yes, it does. And you're not alone, but we are out there. Some of the issues that I raised, the book is kind of twofold. It's about saying we are here and we farm too,
right,
and we have a long history of family farming and farmers markets as well, and we need to really recognize and honor that and make sure we're including not only the black community, but Hispanic, Native American, Asian communities here, all of our diversity of communities that also care about good and healthy food as this movement picks up. But it also is a way to kind of ask those tough questions of, okay, why haven't you met a black farmer? Why?
Well, that's
why
the questions we're
going to
ask. We're going to ask you.
Yes.
You would be sensitized to it since you were biracial and you were farming, and you noticed that most people weren't looking like you when you were doing this.
Sure. Yes, I started getting into farming and growing my own food over 6 years ago, and felt a little alone and felt kind of frustrated with some of the issues in the food system, looking at racial inequities.
Right. Well, of course, there's racial inequity in just about anything, and it's also a money issue, isn't it?
Well, yes. Around the time that I started this project, there was a lawsuit settlement actually being filed. The black farmers against USDA for discrimination. Now, there was a lot of racial inequities, but that discrimination was barring black farmers from accessing money, accessing resources from the USDA so that they could get their loans and get what they needed and keep their farm. So farms were being foreclosed on, and we've had a rapid loss of black farmers. So say that might few and far between looking for black farmers. And, you know, while we're out there, our numbers compared to the majority of farmers, which is about 94% to 96% white male farmers.
Yeah, well, except you present yes. in your book, you present some really strong women farmers of color.
That's right. I dedicated a chapter called Fierce Farming Women to women because we're also the minority in agriculture, and being a woman of color, I felt duly just kind of alone and frustrated. So, yeah, there's quite a struggle. And after the black farmer lawsuit against USDA, women actually filed a lawsuit as well for the same discrimination that they were receiving.
The funny thing is, if you look at history, it seems like after Abraham Lincoln managed to get Congress to pass that first Emancipation Act that said that the colored races were equal, legally at least, as white people. And this was, of course, the drama of the whole movie Lincoln. But it seemed like surely the problem was over, and now land would be available to colored people in the South. But it turned out that's not what happened.
That's not what happened. Land did become available, and slowly black communities were able to start. We have to remember, after emancipation, black folks had no rights, no credit, no capital, nothing, right? Because we were considered not citizens of this country and not equal to the white man. So there was a lot of catching up to do. However, by 1920, black farmers were a million strong. And even before that, black land ownership really started to build up. But there were a lot of discriminatory and racist thread still woven into our country. You know, the emancipation was passed, but it doesn't take away people's hatred and people's kind of mindset, right? So we had things like Jim Crow and Jim Crow laws and all of these policies coming into place to try to make sure that the black community wasn't able to become landowners and start to build their own profits off of their land, like 94% of agricultural owners today.
When did the large transfer of population from the rural South to the manufacturing North. When did that start to take place? Surely that must have been a factor,
yeah,
too.
Exactly, the Great Migration. So right around the time of Jim Crow and the KKK just kind of terrorizing black communities in the South, and then, of course, with industrialization hitting, we see the communities leaving the South because of fear and of heavy oppression there, and then also losing land, losing their own independence and being able to live off of their land, so then looking for work in the North, and the Great Migration, you know, really, we still battle with the results of the Great Migration today as the black community. We have people in the North who are completely disconnected from rural life and that connection with the land and agriculture, forgetting that that's really where we came from. And there are even tons of black families in the North that own land, you know, passed down through heirs' property laws in the South that they're completely unaware of. And so this is a huge problem for black land ownership.
Yeah, interesting thing. I just read a lot of a very interesting issue of Fortune magazine, which talks about the revolutionary changes that are taking place in consumer taste, and not only that, but also in the number of people who are entering agriculture, if you like, for the first time and finding an entry point. But it turns out that the majority of those are migrants, but they're not migrants from the South. They're migrants from halfway across the world in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I interviewed a lot of folks from all over the world that have migrated here and now American citizens, and either came here and started their own farms, or many came here and, as we know, left with no other choice but to become migrant laborers for the large agricultural industry. But we're starting to see that shift of migrant labor transitioning into farm owners. And those are the folks that I focus on. So the book, The Color of Food, about farmers of color, a lot of people come to me and say, oh, you mean migrant farm workers? No, this book is focused on farm owners, people who own their own land, run their own farms. And it was really beautiful, some of the stories of Hmong folks, Filipino folks, Mexican-American folks that have come from their home countries and brought their agricultural knowledge, because a lot of countries that folks migrate from over here are a lot more agrarian than here, and bringing new foods into the market and really contributing to the food movement here.
Well, Natasha, you are a writer and a photographer, and one of the things about this book that's so striking are these absolutely amazing photographs, really in-your-face, honest photographs of people. Now, tell us a little bit more about the project in writing this book. You did some crowd fundraising, did you too?
I did. And so I've always loved photography. I've always loved just how we can capture the essence of folks with the camera. And when I had the idea for The Color of Food back in 2010, I wanted this to really, not only did I want to hear from farmers of color, this community that has been left out of the dialogue of agriculture and the good food movement, but in my own small way, I wanted to try to repaint the picture of agriculture and really show these faces behind our food, the literal color of our food. And so I had a really great community around me as I was farming and kind of tossing around all these ideas of race and agriculture. And I was encouraged to start a community fundraising campaign on one of these sites like Kickstarter. It was called Indiegogo. And I was able to raise over $10,000 in 60 days, which was able to fund some camera equipment and an old 1990s station wagon, which I then drove around the country.
What's your station wagon's name?
Her name was Lucille, named after the late B.B. King's guitar. B.B. King's one of my favorite musicians. Yes.
And
he talked about how his guitar protected him and saved his life, and so I wanted the station wagon to do the same for me as I drove alone around the country.
Lucille. Yeah, I can almost sing it. Yeah.
Please
don't.
Yeah. So we drove around and photographed over 75 different farmers, and their portraits are featured in the book.
And you interviewed them, and you weren't done yet because you have a collage at the back of the book with all the people you couldn't squeeze in.
That's right. So, and you know, even the collage, you know, I interviewed over 75 farmers, and that was 35 are featured in the book. The rest we tried to squeeze in the back, but you know, this is just the tip, very, very tip of the iceberg as far as how many, you know, the diversity of farmers we have out there.
Well, now, where does this go next? I was going to call you Lucille. Maybe I should.
Yes, I miss her. She died after the road trip.
Aww.
So
I guess she has a lot of miles on her.
It was a lot of miles and one of the hottest summers on record, so she was struggling. But as far as the future of this project, you know, the book has just been released this May, and now the focus is really getting these stories out there and trying to do justice for these farmers' stories and get their voices out there as widely as I can. So I travel all over the country presenting some of the stories from the book, presenting the portraits, talking about some of these tough issues as far as the intersection of race and agriculture in our food movement today. The project also lives online on my website, The Color of Food, and on my blog, Brown Girl Farming, where I continue to share snippets and really highlight farmers of color and food activists as well in urban areas around the country, and really just trying to build this movement. I am blessed with some wonderful mentors that kind of opened my eyes to the food movement that's being led by people of color, and I continue to learn and work with them to try to build our movement even stronger.
Now, each one of these individuals or groups has a separate story.
Yes.
And that's the whole point of having these portraits, individual portraits. But is there a thread that runs through them that you would like to highlight?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, I think one of the hardest parts about doing this project is that, you know, every story was so different, and as a people we are all so different, but trying to pull the book together in some sort of, to have these themed chapters and these threads that do run through is the way that I laid out the book. So So the chapters are pretty much summarize kind of some of the threads that are woven into everyone's stories. And so one big focus, the first chapter talks about land, the power dynamic of land ownership. You know, this is a huge, huge impact on all farmers, but particularly heavy for farmers of color. And just kind of our rights over our food, I call it food sovereignty, where we have ownership over our land, our water, our seeds. So these issues came up a lot in everyone's stories. Next was preserving culture and community. So I'm actually working on a piece right now for Yes Magazine that focuses on this. First started farming, I thought, well, the point of this is to grow food and to grow healthy food, right? But what I learned from all of these farmers and their stories, I started to see that these farmers are not just growing food, they're growing community. And they're not just saving seeds, they're saving their cultures. If you look at the stories and just the history that live within our seeds and our food as a people, and all of the different cultures and the sacred traditions and the storytelling that's really woven into agriculture, that's really important for us to save in our communities. So that thread came up a lot in the farmers' stories. And finally, you know, some of the chapters focus, like I said, on women and some of the reasons that a lot of the female farmers started farming seemed to kind of have the same thread. They were doing it for their families. They were doing it for their communities, not to start a business and make profit, but to try to make a difference in their communities. This was a big thread with women farmers. And then finally, the chapter ends with the next generation of farmers and a lot of the young farmers who see farming as this revolutionary act, a kind of return to the land to take control over our food and our lives.
I really wish you a lot of success with this book. I mean, there's so many issues. There's so many things with our food industry. I mean, one hand, I'm happy you wrote the book. On the other hand, I'm sorry to realize there's still yet one more thing wrong with our food industry.
So Natasha.
That's right. The book is a nice celebratory, you know, getting to know these farmers, but it also really serves as a conversation starter and kind of a spark for us to think about the many issues that we still have to face. Right.
You must promise to get back to us in a couple of years and give us an update on how far you've gotten.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I will do.
Okay, again, it's Natasha Bowens, her book called The Color of Food, Stories of Race, Resilience, and Farming, with gorgeous, really honest photographs. Thank you for talking to us, Natasha.
Thanks so much for having me.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and next up, I'd say one of my favorite sites on the internet is Food 52. And one of my favorite columns is Genius Recipes by Kristen. Well, I have trouble with this name because it really looks like it's going to be Migliore, but it's not because there's an I missing for the Li sound. So I'll call it Migliore. She'll correct us anyhow during the interview. At any rate, if you want the definitive genius recipes, you want to know what they are, listen in to Kristen. Well, I followed the development of Food 52 from basically when it was a sparkle in Amanda Hess's eyes and Meryl Streep's eyes. But it was really such a hit. It's taken off. Kristen Migliore, you are one of the first employees that they hired on Food 52. Could we just have a sentence from you about what food52.com is?
Oh, sure. And that's changed a bit over the years. But now we've sort of, the way that we describe it is we're an online cooking and home destination where you can get everything from recipes to how-to articles to a cooking hotline where you can get your questions answered, to a shop that sells local goods from all over the country and the world, small makers, to using your kitchen, to using your home.
Boy, it's really grown.
Yeah.
How many employees now?
We have about 45 employees now.
Wow, that is grown. That's amazing. Well, what we're talking about today, though, is this genius recipes, which is a concept that's way past its time to come. I mean, I said to you before, how many of us have, like, not just dozens, but maybe even hundreds of cookbooks where there's a whole book, but only one recipe that we use out of that book, and yet we hang on to it. Tell us about genius recipes.
Sure. The cookbook that we just released from Food 52 in April, and it's based off of the column that I've been writing for the site for the last 4 years or so. And the concept is, these are recipes that are collected from cooking luminaries who, in the course of their career, have stumbled upon some great trick or simplification of a recipe. And these recipes, as a result, will change the way you cook. And so there are a lot of very iconic recipes, like the cover recipe, which is Marcella Hazan's tomato sauce with butter and onion. And this is sort of, in that way, a greatest hit of recipes from the last 100 years almost.
Well, so that really is the equivalent of the 100 cookbooks I have, with only one recipe that I want out of each one.
Yes, exactly. Actually, I was wondering, you must have a lot of cookbooks. Do you know how many?
We don't count.
No, I have at all times. This is not counting just my personal collection that I have always collected, but I have at all times review copies of about 300 cookbooks.
Oh my gosh!
They're in piles in the hallway of our house.
But that's one reason why we can't downsize our house.
Fortunately, we have a big house, so we have a place. We have lots of places to put things, and most of those places have cookbooks in them.
And the funny thing is, again, how much do you use a cookbook? I mean, most of the time, you just go online if you want something, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny time right now where some people are holding on to their cookbook collections. Some people I've heard are, like, sort of downsizing and moving to e-books. Uh-huh. And then some people are, you know, usually just go online for their recipes. But it is really nice, I've found. Even I tend to use, you know, I have cookbooks that I look through for inspiration and for reference. But if I need to look something up quickly, I will often go online. But it has been really nice for me, even myself, as the author of this book, to be able to pull this book off the shelf to reference things, rather than going and, you know, looking up the recipe that I have somewhere in some file or online, you know, to just be able to flip through.
Yeah, I think that the recipes you've included are really amazing recipes. Many of them I would have just automatically thought of if I would hunt them up, because I'd know them, if you know what I mean.
Yes. And a lot of them are very famous among people who've been cooking for a while.
Now, run us through just some of the people that you include in the recipes that you view as iconic.
Oh, sure. I mean, some of the most famous recipes, if we're kind of talking about the most iconic recipes, I would say Marcella Hazan's tomato sauce, as I mentioned.
Right.
Marion Burroughs's purple plum tort.
Uh-huh.
Marion Cunningham's raised waffles.
Yep.
The no-knead bread from Jim Lee.
Yeah, I was just going to say,
Yes. You know, a lot of these, I would say, they've been famous in their time. Like, for example, the purple plum tort was reprinted for, I think, 7 years in a row in the New York Times by request every September, with usually very little variation. And when there was variation, I think it was a bit controversial. And then finally, I think, gosh, what year was it? Maybe 1989, when she finally decided to stop running it every year, there was an outcry.
No.
So it just continued to have legs. When Amanda Hesser, my boss and the co-founder of Food 52, when she started trying to find the most famous recipes in the history of the New York Times, and she put out a call to the readers of the New York Times asking for their most loved and most famed recipes, that was the number one recipe by far. So she knew she had to include that in the Essential New York Times cookbook.
Yeah, I remember we interviewed her about that.
So in a way, this is sort of like an offspring of the New York Times cookbook, which we interviewed her about whenever that came out.
In a way, it actually could be seen that way, since Food 52 started after Amanda Hester and Meryl Streep worked together on that cookbook for about 6 years. They tested all these recipes going back to the 1850s in the history of the New York Times, and came up with that big, beautiful book. And when they were finally finished working on that after 6 years, they had become great friends and obviously talked a lot about home cooking and how they thought that a lot of the best recipes come from home cooks. You know, as they learned through testing all of these recipes for the New York Times cookbook, and that's what gave them the idea for launching Food 52, because they wanted to have a place for home cooks to be able to share their recipes and their ideas with some of the, you know, modern conveniences that weren't available in, you know, years going back to, in the New York Times, when people would just kind of mail in their recipe and it would get published in the Times.
But this book's a little different, because this book features recipes from chefs who are very famous.
Yes, it is. And it's interesting. It actually is sort of an offshoot of that concept, though, because I get most of my tips, probably, you know, well over half of the tips in this book on the recipes that I included in the Genius Recipes Cookbook came from our readers at Food 52, which is really the only way that I've been able to keep up and find interesting and successful recipes the way that I have been every week for the last 4 years. If I had to find all of these on my own, I just don't think I could. And even if I did, I wouldn't have found as many gems if I didn't have the readers of Food 52 kind of always looking out and sending me their favorites. So, you know, a lot of the most surprising recipes have come from them, because it's easy enough for me to dig up something like the purple plum tort, but some of these other recipes were a little bit more under the radar.
Now, was there anybody that you wanted to include who said, I'm not sharing my recipe in a fit? it's my secret. I mean, it seems to me that if I had a really good recipe, then the last thing I'd want to do is give it away.
Well, it's very, very rare, because in the history of this column, everyone has, I think, considered it, you know, publicity and a bit of an honor to be called a genius. That's the great thing about having this be called Genius Recipes, is that, and we really give ample credit. You know, there's no part of this that's trying to say this is my recipe. This is always, you know, it's you know, Barbara Lynch's spicy tomato soup on the site. You know, it's those things where you give a shout out to the person who created it and celebrate their contribution and then explain the recipe. So there's really been hardly any resistance to sharing people's recipes. And, you know, with the internet, it's so common for people to share in that way,
right,
that it's probably refreshing to them to see someone who isn't just adapting a recipe and then saying, this is my recipe adapted from someone else. I'm not claiming to even have any ownership over these recipes whatsoever.
Right. Now, you've subtitled this 100 Recipes That Will Change the Way You Cook. And I think that in terms of the mission of this book, that last phrase, will change the way you cook, is important to you. Am I correct?
Oh, yes, very much.
Could you amplify?
Yes. So the way I see the recipes in this book, I see them in two ways. I think that they're good for the types of cooks who are just looking for the best, simplest path to what they're hoping to make. They want to make a roast chicken. They don't know which roast chicken to make because the internet has thousands of roast chicken recipes.
you know, and they don't want to have to stumble through and sift through all the different bloggers' opinions about it and make a bunch of different variations. They just want to go straight to a really great one. And so that, so this recipe, or this book is great for people who really rely on well-vetted recipes, but it's also really good for people who just like to use recipes as a guide and for inspiration and for new ideas. And there's always kind of a takeaway from each recipe. Oh, I could be, I could be putting wine vinegar on my fried eggs, no matter if I follow this recipe or I just fry eggs the way I like to, splash a little wine vinegar in the pan and then pour it over my eggs. It's a new idea. So that's the idea, is that once you make these recipes, whether you decide to continue following them exactly every time after that, or if you want to kind of put your own spin on them, they are the gold standard for how you would want to make that particular thing. And you don't forget it and just move on to the next one. It changes the way you think about cooking that dish.
Well, you also like to sort of simplify things as well, don't you? And your tips are very brief. These the mini recipes that accompany longer recipes are distilled to a couple paragraphs. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there are some recipes in here that really you need the full, list of instructions from the original author, the full list. And then there are some that are just such a simple idea that you can kind of distill them into a quick paragraph. Like, for example, the one ingredient, banana ice cream. It's so simple, I could tell it to you in about 10 words, probably. Freeze bananas in chunks, blend. There you go. So you don't really need a full page with a recipe. You can kind of just add that in as another idea alongside another ice cream recipe.
Well, I'm having fun with the book because so many of these people are friends or we've previously interviewed them, you know, and it's fun sort of, just, I'd like to just start at the beginning and work my way through trying them all. I'm just looking here. Now, we just interviewed Michelle Nichon, who got Humanitarian of the Year through the James Beard.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, wonderful.
Yeah, and his recipe is use a spoon chopped salad. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yes, and that's I love the quirky names too. They you know, we tried very hard not to change the names to try and make them consistent in any way. We wanted the original voice of each chef or cookbook author to kind of shine through. And that one is it's really good, but it has a few other things about it part of it is the fact that it's chopped so fine that you use a spoon to eat it, which is lovely. But also, I love the way that he uses, instead of making a dressing and just using that to coat all these chopped vegetables, he actually pickles a few of the vegetables first. Mm-hmm. And so it just adds another kind of layer of nuance in the whole thing.
Yeah, well, he's very invested in Wholesome Wave right now, but there's no denying his talent as a chef. I mean, he just, even when he was cooking at places like the W Hotel, it was healthy, but it was so flavorful. I'd try any recipe that he, now, there are some recipes that I trust Paul Bertoli, but I don't know if I would do this cauliflower soup. It doesn't sound really interesting.
Exactly. That's exactly where having the Food 52 community to tell me when something really is great has saved me, because I never would have found that recipe if it wasn't for someone writing in and saying, no, this sounds terrible, but you really should try it.
It really does sound terrible. It's just cauliflower and the water and an onion.
Yeah.
that's all it takes. That's all it takes.
Yeah. What's also sort of fun about that one is I published that recipe not really knowing why it was so good, and I just sort of put it out there. And then a reader in the comments told me it's because of the pectin that's in cauliflower. Pectin is in fruit for thickening jams, and it also happens to be very prominent in cauliflower, and so that's what thickens and makes the soup very creamy without having to use heavy cream or a lot of butter or something like that.
Well, you know, you were known for really exhaustive testing of recipes. And so I imagine that these all work pretty well.
That's the idea. Well, and also, I test them at home in my little kitchen in Brooklyn, and then I also test them in our kitchen at Food 52. So they'll work on a variety of, you know, whether you have a great kitchen to work with or a not-so-great kitchen. But also, they've been tested by, you know, the community members who sent them in to me and by whoever was testing for the original author. So it's like they've been vetted so many times that, yeah, they are pretty foolproof at this point.
Well, I'm sure you won't go to the extreme I'm just going to mention, but you won't recommend everybody throw away their gazillion cookbooks and just buy this one, put this one on the shelf. But
no.
It's kind of close to it. I think, Kristen, it's going to be a smash hit, and I can see it as the cookbook of choice for gift-giving this spring, too.
So, thank you so much.
I mean, I could see it for graduation gifts and whatnot. So, well, congratulations on this completion of this book, and you're going to continue with your genius recipes column?
Yes, that's full steam ahead. And we also have two more cookbooks coming out in the fall in the same imprint that we've started with 10 Speed Press, which is called Food 52 Works. They're going to be on single subjects. One is on vegan cooking and one is on simple weeknight baking. So those are the next things that we have coming out that'll be in the same vein as Genius Recipes, but just a slightly smaller single subject style.
I can't even I can't imagine weekday baking, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like one bowl cakes and, you know, like really simple cobblers and things like that.
Well, as I said, good luck and success on this book and on continuing developing this wonderful site of food52.com. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us, Kristen.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been a real treat.
Thanks.
We sure hope you enjoyed today's program and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.